Welcome to the Johan René podcast, where we dabble in philosophy, sample a little culture, perform some politics, grapple with history, and make the dip into religion. With me, your gezonde Dutch host, Johan René Schaper. Okay, everyone, welcome to the Johan René podcast. I am your host, Johan René, and today we're going to talk about Hanukkah a little bit, but we're going to really talk about Second Temple period, and with me is a wonderful guest, Dr. Professor Malka Simkovic. She is a published author of two books now.
Yes.
Two books. One on, I have it down. What are the titles of your books?
The Making of Jewish Universalism and Discovering Second Temple Literature.
Right. I have not read them. I want to read the second one. Sounds like really up my alley. The reason I asked you on is because very Hanukkah themed, someone online asked me, why is the Book of Maccabees not in the biblical canon, in the Jewish canon? And I gave like a standard answer, like, oh, according to Chazal, the prophecy had ended already, so it couldn't be a prophetic book. And as I was answering, I was like, well, I don't even know if that was their standard in the Second Temple. That's like sort of a later standard, maybe imposed, sort of an exile imposed on it. I don't know. The Gemara Megillah uses similar arguments to see if the Megillah's Esther is divinely inspired or not, but it really doesn't discuss if it's going to be in the canon. Maybe that's just a separate conversation. So I was like, yeah, I talk about this. I think about this stuff, and I just know Chazal a little bit, but I don't really know what was flying in the Second Temple period. So I figured, you know, I'm going to ask you. So when we say the biblical canon, right? Chazal has in Bava Basra. I should have written this down.
Bava Basra, yeah.
Yeah, they have a whole list of the 22 books. That's the books we have now, and they have some debates. But what is the biblical canon, and what is it in Yiddishkeit? And could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the canon doesn't really come into full completion until the rabbis begin to use books and they take pieces of paper and sew them together. This is actually probably a practice that's borrowed from the early Christian community in the second or third century CE. And so when the Jewish community in the rabbinic period start to use this very portable and very affordable method of copying their sacred scriptures, then there's kind of urgency that arises because they have to decide what goes into these collections of sewn pages. But in the Second Temple period, there's no sense of urgency because the sacred scriptures are written on scrolls. And so you'll have a scroll of Genesis, a scroll of Exodus, a scroll of Leviticus, and they're very, very expensive. So the average person, the average Jewish person in the Second Temple period is not going to have a scroll of every book, or, you know, I say book, but I mean a scroll that they consider sacred just because it was prohibitively expensive. However, if you were wealthy, you could commission a scroll, but you might not commission a scroll of every book, again, in quotation marks, that you consider sacred. You might just commission a scroll of those texts that you think are the most interesting or your favorite. So you might have, the Pentateuch, the first five books, the Torah, but then you might not have Joshua, or you might have Joshua and you might have the books of the prophets, but you might also have a scroll of Jubilees, or you might also have a scroll of Tobit, and you might not have a scroll of Esther, but you might have a scroll of Judith, and you could add a scroll and you could take a scroll off the shelf. And so there's a kind of fluidity, categorically, conceptually, but also like in a very, very concrete way, there's a fluidity until Jews start to put all of these books together in one big Biblos, in one big Bible.
So now here's the question then. So you mentioned the Book of Judith, you mentioned the Book of Jubilees. These are all Apocrypha, right? Is that the word we use?
Well, Jubilees is not preserved in the Apocrypha. The Apocrypha has a very narrow definition. The Apocrypha, that category comprises of the texts that are preserved in the Septuagint, in the Greek version of the Bible that Christians are using. And in this Septuagint, you have books such as Tobit, Judith, 1 Maccabees, 2 Maccabees, and many others, but not Jubilees. Jubilees is considered sacred by many Jews in the second century BCE and later, but is never canonized in the Jewish tradition. It's not even canonized in most Christian traditions. It is canonized in a few Christian
Ethiopians.
Traditions. Yes, exactly. Ethiopic, right, exactly. And today it's considered part of an ever-expanding collection called the Pseudepigrapha, which is sort of a fake term.
Right. Yeah. I've seen a lot of these terms flying around. Apocrypha, deuterocanonical. And I realize a lot of them also have to do with like Christian ideological fights, what the status of these books are. Like whether you're high church, Protestant, or like an evangelical, they have different views. I realize that. And they have many fights about this also, debates. Quick question about the Septuagint. This is always wondered. When we say Septuagint, it's in the Septuagint. Are we talking about a fourth century text that was compiled from older texts, or does the Second Temple have a Septuagint with a canon?
I think what you're asking is, was it all translated at one time? Right? Like, so the Torah is translated into Greek in the third century BC, purportedly by a Ptolemy II Philadelphus, I think, in Alexandria. The story is recorded in a pseudepigraphic text called Letter of Aristeas. It's later retold by Philo of Alexandria and other later historians. So the Pentateuch is translated into Greek quite early, but the Septuagint as we know it is a product of centuries of work. Over time, later books of the Hebrew Bible are translated, the prophets and the writings. And so by the early Common Era, you have the Septuagint, this grand translation of the Hebrew Bible, that doesn't come into existence overnight. It takes centuries.
Right. Is the Book of Maccabees in the Septuagint?
It is, yes.
I saw there's four books of Maccabees. Right. Maccabees. Maccabees. But only the first one is in there, right? Or the second one also?
So again, it depends on like what kind of expanded Bible, what kind of expanded canon list you're dealing with. Right. But no, the first two books, so one Maccabees and two Maccabees are preserved in the Apocrypha. And certainly in some Christian canon lists, three Maccabees and four Maccabees. And one Maccabees and two Maccabees are very, very different. They're very different texts. One is Judean, one is diasporan. One is written with a real focus on promoting the legitimacy and authority of the Hasmonean family. The other is really focused on the temple and Jerusalem. So they're very different books.
The second one is more focused on the temple.
Yeah.
Does that tie in that old Jewish debate whether the miracle or the war is more important? And then they say early on with Hanukkah, we say the war against the Greeks was the most important. And then by the time Chazal comes around, we kind of emphasize a particular miracle over, does that reflect also in these two books that like-
Well, more... it does reflect. And I also use this argument to sort of fight back against Jews to say, well, in the Second Temple period, Jews were talking about the military aspect. And then the rabbinic period, they talked about the theological aspect, because really very, very early on after the war, almost immediately after the war, Jews are theologizing the story to make it meaningful for every Jew, even those Jews who weren't in the war. So only two generations after the war, people are, you know, two Maccabees is produced, it is being circulated and transmitted, becomes very popular, people are reading it, ultimately in many languages. And this is a book that really is theologizing, looking for added meaning to make it appeal to all Jews throughout the Hellenistic world. And so in that sense, you know, Jews are searching for meaning in this story very early on. So I wouldn't create a dichotomy between, you know, the Second Temple sources do the military thing, the rabbinic sources do this thing, because it's really like almost immediately after it happens, Jews are saying, what does this mean?
Right. Sometimes people want to say, oh, the miracle is a later invention. I'm like, maybe that miracle story is an early miracle story that was just not focused on, and then later generations overemphasized that. We see that in Chazal many times.
I mean, I think it's definitely true. One of the most fun mysteries that we have in Second Temple literature is that Josephus, the late first century historian, tells us that when he's recalling the origins of the story of Hanukkah, he says the story is commemorated with this holiday that Jews call lights. But then Josephus says, I don't know why they call it lights.
Oh, wow.
And that's at the end of the first century. He's like, we have this tradition and I don't know, that the story behind it is lost. And so then he kind of fudges along, and he says, well, maybe it's allegorical that we had a dark situation and then there was like the light of salvation. But that's such a cheap shot for Josephus, because really that could apply to any single thing. Like, I lost my keys, darkness, but then I found my keys. I will call the moment of finding my keys light. Like, it just doesn't really work. So there's clearly an ancient story already by the first century that's been lost. And so that's just a very interesting clue. There's also a letter that's attached to 2 Maccabees that's dated to the first century BCE that associates the holiday with miracles of fire in the temple. So again, there are all these little clues that are Second Temple clues.
I never heard this. I always jokingly call myself a bar machlokes because I like to see where everyone disagrees. I never heard this. Wow, that's very interesting. Yeah. Do you feel that we sometimes overemphasize Josephus and Philo historical importance because that's just what we have? But like, it's not like a collection of an academy published or anything. It's like just a guy writing in Rome, not just a guy, a very important, interesting guy. But I feel like we overemphasize them just because we have that.
It's a huge problem, right? I mean, we only have 5 collections of texts from the Second Temple period. We have the Apocrypha, the Pseudepigrapha, which is sort of like ever expanding. It's not even like a real collection. It's just like all random texts that have religious significance but weren't canonical. And then we have the Dead Sea Scrolls, Philo, and Josephus. That's it. That's all we have. Apocrypha, Pseudepigrapha, Philo, Josephus, and the Dead Sea Scrolls. But we do this with the Dead Sea Scrolls.
The New Testament.
That's right.
The New Testament.
Thank you. That's true. Thank you for saying that. Also comprises important Jewish writings. That's true. I think that when you have these very restrictive categories, it's very tempting to say this writer is representative of, you know, for Philo, of all diasporan Jewish thinking. For sure, that's not true, right? Likewise with Josephus. Is Josephus representative of like a typical Jewish? No. I mean, Josephus, his life story is so unique that you cannot argue. But we do this with the Dead Sea Scrolls. We say, oh, wow, Second Temple Judaism is so sectarian and fractured and politicized. No, that was a community of 100 or so people. And we happen to be very lucky to find, you know, almost 1,000 distinct texts from their library. But it doesn't mean that this represents the average Jew and how they lived and how they thought. So this is a problem.
Right. I looked in some canonical, but it tried to debate how to reconstruct the canon of the earlier period, which you clearly don't hold up as a strict canon. And they're like, oh, Philo doesn't quote this. Yeah, and I'm like, yeah, I also don't quote everything.
Right.
The Dead Sea Scrolls, this book is not there. But yeah, that was like a snippet of Daniel. I think if that was stuck under someone's shoe, then we would now say that Daniel wasn't there. You know, like it's just, Josephus says there's 22 books. And he also quotes from Maccabees. So clearly he didn't hold Maccabees divinely inspired. I'm like, I don't know what he held. He doesn't talk about them.
Right, absolutely. That's why I try to use the term scriptural or authoritative. I tend to not say canonical because, yes, there were texts that Jews believed were authoritative. Does that mean that, you know, there's a whole collection of books that are rejected? No, you know, but they definitely were reading, let's say, like the Book of Enoch, you know?
Yes.
So what was that? Was that they respected it, but it wasn't scriptural? Or it was, you know what I mean? Like there's so much fluidity in these categories. These are modern categories.
Yeah, and they didn't think historically about things. Like, I wonder, like, did they really believe Enoch wrote this? And then I'm thinking, well, I don't know how they think about these texts. Do we have evidence that they sometimes exaggerated or they put authors' names to it and they themselves didn't believe these authors wrote it? Like it's sort of like the Greeks do that often, like they re-spin their myths and put new things on. And I feel that all the Greeks were aware of that. Do you think that happens also in the Jewish, with the Apocrypha, like when we have these texts that claim to be from the time of Adam Arishon, basically, and then like the Book of Enoch? Or
yes, that's a really great question. Like, what did they think about these texts? I mean, the whole category of pseudepigrapha means falsely attributed writings, because you have all these works that are written in the Hellenistic period that are attributed to biblical heroes. Baruch. There are multiple books attributed to Ezra that are being written in the first century or even later. the letter of Jeremiah, a letter attributed to Yirmiyahu. So you have all these texts that are clearly stylistically Hellenistic, many of them written in Greek, circulating in Greek. So as the average, you're thinking, you know, these are the ancient words of the biblical prophet, or was, is this, you know, something closer to like fan fiction getting into the head of the biblical hero? It's a really fascinating question. I think it's also an open question. I mean, I don't know that like we have to come out on one side or another. And then the question is also, you know, what's your angle? What's the perspective of the writer? Who is he imagining his audience to be? And is that correlative with the actual people who end up reading this text? I do think that by the rabbinic period, there's a little bit less license when it comes to sort of allowing authors to speak in the voice of the ancient biblical heroes. And so what is one sort of, what is in the late Second Temple period is sort of free imaginary exercise becomes, comes to be read as more historically archival.
Do you think Midrash then replaced more the creative part, like the Midrash Rabbah, where it's just like seven opinions on the same topic and they all disagree? So clearly, you know, is that more like, I don't know what I'm going with this, but yeah, do you think that the Midrash maintains sort of a creativity that then the scriptures lose?
Yeah, no, I absolutely do. And of course, many of these Midrashic traditions that are written down in the later or even early rabbinic period derive from the Second Temple period and are circulating orally for many centuries before they become written down. And I definitely as well think that there is more similar than different. You know, many of us sort of assume that the temple falls in 70 CE and then like we're in a totally new period and it's completely different than everything in 69 CE and life is different and reality is different and thinking is different. But the truth is like there's more that bridges these periods than divides them. And we, you know, we do ourselves a disservice when we think like Second Temple Judaism, sectarian, you know, Hellenistic and sort of sectarian, you know, all these things, all these labels right. that we put on the Second Temple period. But then, you know, we go into 71 C and it's like, well, rabbinic normativity and everyone's speaking Hebrew.
Yeah, I see that in the older books, there's like sort of this artificial Council of Yavne, which there is a Sanhedrin situation going on. I know exactly what's going on. And they want to just pin down everything. This is the rabbinic revolution. Or they just invented the whole thing. And you read the Chazal, what they did, like you can't blow shofar on Shabbos. Like, okay, like, wow, revolutionary. I mean, it is revolutionary for us Jews. It's like, what do you mean? You can't blow shofar on Shabbos, what? Right. But to like, that where like this whole new religion is invented by these like, these doctors of rabbinic Judaism at Yavne. And then I see later on in the modern literature doesn't really assume that anymore.
Right, absolutely. There has definitely been a change in recent scholarship. Actually, there's a really interesting book edited by Daniel Schwartz that has a great title. The name of the book is, Was 70 CE Really a Watershed in Jewish History? it's a great book of collected essays by scholars. Basically, the trend now is to say maybe it wasn't the watershed that we assumed it to be.
Right. The Book of Maccabees, it was originally written in Greek, or we just preserved it all?
The first Maccabees was written originally in Hebrew, but later circulated in Greek.
A friend of mine, we had a discussion about this, and a friend of mine said, well, the Book of Maccabees sets itself as a divinely inspired kind of, it wants to be biblical. He's not an expert. He just suggested this to my original question. And I was thinking like, I don't even know what that means. Like, what does it mean to be biblical? But do these texts assume sort of a higher authority of the author, or?
That's a great question. I mean, some other texts outside of the Maccabees books absolutely do. You know, the opening of Jubilee sort of situates itself as a prophetic scene, a prophetic set of writings that Moses receives. So definitely there's an interest in some of these texts in the Second Temple period to imbue themselves with authority. In 1 Maccabees, no, I don't see that. However, there are some interesting biblical themes that the writer intentionally draws from. So one really interesting thing that the writer of 1 Maccabees does is he speaks about Israel, and the word Yisrael is so theologically, it's like a heavy, heavy word. Yisrael, of course, is not just the other name of Jacob. It's this covenantal term this. So it's used in a way, it enables the author to invoke God's promises of salvation. Mm. And so when he speaks about the Jews of Judea in 175 BC as Israel, and he uses this word over and over and over, the argument that he's making to his readers is you are the recipients of God's covenantal promises. You're part of the story. And so it could be that your friend is right in the sense that the author is situating the story on a continuum of salvation that argues for an elevated understanding of what happened in 164 BC with the rededication of the temple. It could be that the author really perceives this as another salvation story in sort of this broader spectrum of stories that begins in the early biblical period. And so Israel is sort of like a red flag, you know? So there are other terminological choices that the author uses to make it sound like a biblical text. So I do kind of understand maybe where he's coming from. Was the text read as a scriptural document? I highly doubt it.
Hmm. I thought someone was coming in my room. I have kids and, you know, I told them not to come in. When we talk about the period of the Maccabees, I keep saying Maccabees, is there a Judaism around that we have, would we recognize in Chazal, or is it like just everyone for themselves, or what kind of Judaism, I don't know what I'm going with, what kind of Judaism is the text assuming, and what kind of Judaism do we assume was there?
I have to tell you, I completely understand your question, and I love it. Good. Because we talk about Judaism like it is a fixed religion in the second century BC, and to be a Jew meant the same thing wherever you live. And whatever Judaism was, it was in imminent conflict with what we would call Hellenism, as if these are two separate things. And they're sort of like hurtling towards each other for this like imminent explosion. Now, a few things. First of all, Jews lived under a Hellenistic cultural umbrella beginning in 323 BC. So what about the first 150 years? I mean, things seem to be okay, right? Like Jews are living under Hellenism as soon as Alexander the Great dies, and they seem fine. So that already calls this binary into question. The other thing that's interesting is that the word Judaism doesn't really become used until much, 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 much later, but one of the very few texts that uses the word Judaism is 2 Maccabees.
But where would that be? It's like Yadus or something?
Judaismos.
Oh, every, wow. That's like literally, wow.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the first time we see the word in Greek. So again, you know, is this a cultural? Now, if I were to ask, well, I don't know what your various citizenships are.
But I only have one. That's the Kingdom of the Netherlands.
Okay, so.
A permanent resident here in the United States.
So you have a lot of identities. But like, if I were to ask you, are you, you know, of the Netherlands, or are you a Jew? Or like if someone were to ask me, like, are you American or are you a Jew?
Right.
That's not a question that I would really understand, because, and I would also take offense to it. I'm not one or the other, and they don't stand outside of each other. I'm not only a Jew in my home in private or only American in public. And so in the ancient world, I think likewise, most Jews would have been very confused by the question, are you a Hellenist or are you a Jew? Are you in Hellenismos or are you in Judaismos? As if these are two separate things.
Right, that's very,
I think it would have been very confusing. Like, well, we are Jews who are proudly identifying in public as Jews, and yet we embrace much of what the Hellenistic world has to offer us. So even the most Jewish of texts are using Hellenistic stylistics. Pathos, soliloquy, right? Like all these sort of like dramatic tools that they have, they're embracing this cultural world. So, right. So already, okay, so what does it mean to be a Jew? So it doesn't mean to not be Hellenistic. What it means is to observe three main identifiers of Jewish life: Sabbath, circumcision, dietary law. And then on top of that, to come together regularly and read the scriptures in the synagogue. That to me is the baseline of Jewish practice in the Greco-Roman world.
Right, Josephus says, he brings up the Essenes and the Sadducees, and of course the Pharisees, and he self-identifies as a Pharisee. But then he says the people in the villages followed the traditions of the Pharisees, which of course, as an Orthodox Jew, I'm like, oh, there you see, this one guy says it. But also in the New Testament, it seems that the Rambam Gamliel is like dominant in the Sanhedrin, and the Pharisees, Jesus says, the Pharisees are sitting on the seat of Moses, right, in the Gospel of Matthew. So that the Pharisees seem to be the predominant culture. And of course, I as an Orthodox Jew want to say, oh, see, Rabbinic Judaism. Are the Sadducees clearly the predecessor of Rabbinic Judaism, whatever that means?
So I would say, I mean, the loose answer, the sloppy answer is yes. Yes, they are the predecessors of Rabbinic Judaism. But Josephus also gives us very interesting numbers. You know, you're talking about, let's say, you know, 600,000 to 1 million Jews in Judea. And again, this is like very conservative and there are all kinds of questions about figuring out these numbers. But when Josephus says—
against the Epiod, he has like an interesting thing where he calculates the Jews based on the temple. Anyway, go on.
Right. I love, that's my favorite work against Zappion of all his works. But
me too, because I'm a Balmachlokus. Go on.
It's just so great. He just gets so mad. But so he says there are 6,000 Pharisees, 4,000 Sadducees, and 3,000 Essenes. And Josephus is known to inflate his numbers. But even let's say if that's correct, in the first century, 6,000 Pharisees, 4,000 Sadducees, 3,000 Essenes, you're talking about a very, very tiny portion of the population. Now, it doesn't mean that they're not in the public eye. For sure, you know, at least the Sadducees and the Pharisees are occupying positions of leadership that capture the interest of the people. But does that mean that, you know, you have to choose an allegiance as a Jew in the first century and you have to choose a sectarian allegiance? No, I'm not convinced at all that that's what it means. In fact, I think that the average Jew in Judea did not have to choose an allegiance and sort of was watching this as a common, you know, what I call an observer of common Judaism. So Sabbath, dietary law, circumcision, coming together to read the scriptures. And then sort of, you know, like we are all aware of our government, but it doesn't mean we're all civically engaged.
Right.
Right.
Like, yeah, it's like the Middle Ages. You have the mystics and the traditionalists, right. But like your Yiddish Bobby is just keeping Shabbos. He's not, I don't hold with Aristotle. I don't think the Rambam didn't read
Precisely. Yeah. And that tends to be my take when it comes to the first century as well. Yeah. You're talking about a tiny population that's actively identifying within these sectarian groups. And yes, because they are, you know, in these leadership positions, people are interested. And there are definitely people who obey the instructions of the Pharisees, as Josephus says. But to what extent that means there's a kind of normative proto-rabbinic way of life, you know, there I get skeptical.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. It makes sense. I want to sneak back to the canon. I was just thinking about it the other day. You mentioned the Book of Enoch, and I had the Book of Enoch when I was just converting to Judaism. I was like, oh, I should buy this. So I bought the Nag Hammadi. I don't know if you know what the Nag Hammadi is. It's like the Gnostic Egyptian text from the Christians from the fourth century who are not mainstream Christians. And I bought the Book of Enoch and I bought the Sefer Yetzirah because, you know, when you're converting to, when you're looking into a religion and into ideas, you just buy random things. You don't know where to look. But I was thinking, like, if there would be a hurricane and my house would be destroyed and they find the Book of Enoch, they would say, oh, this Jew, or if I wasn't Jewish, this person held Book of Enoch canonical because you just happened to find it in my house. And I feel a little bit of the Dead Sea Scrolls or all these things, we don't have like, I don't know, we already said this, but I just wanted to bring up this story because I thought it was funny.
No, I mean, I think it's absolutely true. And I think, you know, I like to say this because it sounds controversial, but I also mean it. I think that the Dead Sea Scrolls was the worst thing to happen to the discipline of Second Temple Judaism.
Oh,
because everybody, you know, when they hear, like when I have conversations with people that I'm just getting to know, they say, oh, you study the Second Temple period. Tell me about the Dead Sea Scrolls. And I don't want to.
I'm big buddies with Dr. Schiffman, so we have to be careful here. But yeah,
I love Dr. Schiffman, but you know, I think he would agree that you're not dealing with a library that's representative of the common practice of Judaism. It's intriguing and fascinating, but you're not even dealing with a sectarian group. You're dealing with a breakaway of a sect, like a subsect of a sect, because the actual sect was not sectarian enough for the subsect. These are Essenes right. who broke away from city life. There were other Essenes, Josephus tells us, living in the cities.
This is the Amish to the Mennonites.
Yeah, that's a good Right. So that's a good comparison. So yes, exactly. When you find the Damascus document or, you know, something that's very specific to this group, and then you try to glean some information about Second Temple Judaism, this is a really, this could be methodologically really problematic.
Right. But I think that, is it the Damascus? There's one of the texts where it's just like an angry rant of what's going on in the temple. And I think we could derive certain comparisons with Chazal that, like, okay, we do kind of know there was something going on in the temple that kind of...
Yes, well, the Pesher documents, right? So with these little interpretive documents of the minor prophets and some other prophetic works in the Hebrew Bible, interpret these as predictions of the sect's break with the Jerusalem leadership. And that's a goldmine historically. This is very, very interesting. So I'm not saying that the Dead Sea Scrolls are worthless. I'm just saying that when you're going to say, oh, well, this teaches us that, you know, Jews in the Second Temple period were sectarian, or, you know, whatever you want to say, purity obsessed. That's a big one. Right. They're obsessed with purity. Well, yes, there are 10 mikvahs found at the site of Qumran. 10, that's a lot. You're talking about a small archaeological site. 10 mikvahs means something very serious. Does that feed into our already existent bias that Jews are obsessed with purity laws? I mean, unfortunately, it does, but it shouldn't.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, that's yes. See, I'm glad we're talking about this, because I think a lot of these things, but I'm not a scholar and I don't have access to all these like fancy libraries online that you have to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars for if you're not in academia. But I'm glad to, I feel vindicated here a little bit.
Yes, you should.
Yeah, people ask me sometimes, like, oh, they talk about the Masoretic text and the preservation of the text, and they're like, oh, the Dead Sea Scrolls have like one letter difference. I'm like, which one? The Proto-Samaritan? Like, apparently it's different. Like, there's different proto-texts that we call, and there's different versions of the text. And I don't know if that was just like, maybe they just put them there because they were all fallacious. Like, oh, this is craziness. You know, I mean, like,
right. People can't handle it. Yeah.
People get Emuna problems from this. I don't, you know, one of the blessings is that I wasn't raised Jewish. Is that I don't have like drilled in me that like there's not a lot of difference like this kind of stuff.
Well, I always say that. I say it's such a problem that we place this at the center of our faith experience and our faith journeys. Like this idea, and it becomes inculcated at such an early age. I mean, I have 4 kids going through Jewish day schools, and it's such a central idea that every single, you know, tag vatag, every single little letter comes straight from God. And, you know, there's so many things that we could put at the center of our emuna. There's so many things. What about the deep belief that we have this covenantal, everlasting relationship, that there's a divine concern for the covenantal relationship? That to me seems really, really fundamental.
Right.
But I think it could be really problematic to insist on that reality that every single letter comes from. Yeah.
Yeah. I wasn't even understand. I just like, there's Chazals that discuss, there's different, that the temple had 3 scrolls and they compared them. And then you have Rishonim that said, well, it's not possible if it's this letter, because like over there in Poland, I saw a text that was like this, and here in Morocco, it is. Like, it was like medieval debates about that. And it's like, it seems to be that everyone is very aware of it right up until like, not everyone, just people that were busy with it, like, was aware of this, like, letter differences right up until it became a Kiruv argument or something.
I think it's true. Yeah, Ibn Ezra's famous, you know, 7 last verses that he says weren't written, and there are other verses in the Torah that he says weren't written.
Oh, yeah, that's a whole can of words. I mean, have you found this Yudah Chassid's text, who was just, like, assuming, like, large parts were edited in by the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, and, like, you know, I know, yeah, you know, but that's a whole different discussion, like sort of textual criticism of the text. I want to go back though to the Judaism of the Second Temple and Chazal. How do I want to say this? You think there is a continuation between the transmission of the texts that Chazal is talking about as canonical, is that did they have other texts around at that time that they excluded? I know in the Gemara they exclude they exclude one of, this escapes me for a second, but they exclude some books from the text, and they discuss if like some of the books of Shlomo should be in there. But did they have even the Book of Maccabees at that time, or the Book of Jubilees, or just they have a limited access to these books?
Right. I mean, I think that it's pretty clear that they don't have most of these books because by then, first of all, they're circulating in Greek. And second of all, they've basically been co-opted by the church. But they do have some books that they read with great regard, but don't consider them canonical. The best example is probably Ben Sira, which is a second century.
That's the one I meant. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they cite it. And again, so the question is, like, do they cite it as canonical or as authoritative? You know, there are all these words that are these modern categories that I don't know that they thought about or that they thought with, we don't have any evidence that the rabbis ever read Ben Sira as canonical, and yet it does seem to be authoritative, or maybe not authoritative, but read as a book that, they held this book in high regard. And then of course, the Book of Enoch as well seems to have been available in some rabbinic circles.
Yeah. Yeah, and yeah, there's also like, there's references, I think, in Chazal to Judith as a story, but I don't know as the book, because like, just because they mentioned the story doesn't mean that that story is only preserved in that book or that that book is still around with them.
Yeah, exactly. And I would say, you know, even in Midrashic literature, we have so many interesting stories that seem to have origins in Second Temple documents that are not canonical. So for example, great example, actually.
The prayer of Mordechai in the Book of Esther.
Oh, in Greek Esther. Oh, that's a good one.
That's a midrash like that.
Interesting. I mean, there are a lot of examples, but I was thinking about the 10 tests of Abraham.
Okay.
The 10 tests of Abraham, which...
In Pirkei Avos.
Yes, but also in the Book of Jubilees.
Oh, okay.
And the 7 Noahide laws.
I just read them.
Right. There's so many examples, but also like Midrashic stories about, there's a good one with baby Moses on Pharaoh's lap. So in Josephus preserves a story about how baby Moses is sitting on Pharaoh's lap and he takes the crown from Pharaoh and throws it on the ground and Pharaoh freaks out. And it's very parallel, but not identical to the Midrash about Moshe with the, you know, being given a bowl of coals and a bowl of jewels, and he reaches for the jewels and the angel comes and puts his hand in the coals, and then he puts his hand in his mouth, and that's why he's a Rosh Hashanah. But it's like a very, very parallel scene. So again, you know, these stories are circulating. They're circulating orally in various communities and various iterations, and then they become written down.
Right. This is so interesting. Yeah, I was thinking in the New Testament, I wasn't raised a Christian. I just want my audience to know. Like, if Christians here, I converted from Christianity, they have an emotional hang up, like, oh my God. But if I just like some secular guy become Jewish, they're like, oh, interesting. So I always make that clear. I was not a Christian, but I did read the New Testament a lot. It was fun. And, you know, the letter of Jude mentions like pieces from the Book of Enoch. As if authoritative, but then the Christians never accepted that, I think. I mean, I think Augustine quotes it sometimes, but they never accepted it as their canon. And
I would have to look that up, because I think that there are some early Christian canon lists that have Enoch, but I would want to double check. But Enoch is very significant to them because there's this figure in Enoch of the Son of God.
Right.
Yeah, so that's very significant. It becomes like a proto-Christian text.
But it wasn't not originally, no, obviously it predates
Christianity. No, it was not. Yeah, I mean, I would be very comfortable reading this as a Jewish apocalyptic text. First of all, it has many complicated compositional layers, and it seems to be messianic apocalyptic text that later Christians say, oh, wow, the Son of God, we can work with that. Right. That seems to be resonant with us.
It also has like, you know, sometimes you have these Jewish statements online. Oh, we don't believe in fallen angels. That's a Christian idea. The Book of Enoch talks about fallen angels. Now, just because Judaism now doesn't accept that book doesn't mean that like that idea is made up by Christians. It predates Christianity by Jews.
Absolutely.
It's a lot of interesting stuff. It's a lot of interesting stuff, and I want to talk more, but we're already almost up to an hour, I think. So
wow.
Yeah, we should. Yeah, maybe. I find it just an interesting. I hope my listeners don't think it was like a big chulent of different things, because I find the spirit very interesting. But I, you know, I just don't know enough. Like, I don't. No one pays me to research this all day.
You know a lot more than the average Jew, I think.
I appreciate that.
I think most people, most of my friends, there's no reason to encounter these texts. There's just no reason. You know, we don't get them in formal education, and we don't get them in shul. And so, yeah, I mean, I think if you want to encounter them, you have to take the initiative to find them.
Yeah. Let me ask you one question just about academia. I noticed researching these topics over the years that a lot of it's like, for instance, there's a big fight between the Protestants and the Catholics and the Orthodox about the Apocrypha, but also about the Masoretic texts. And it seems there's a fight. Like, the Protestants want to say the Jewish canon is the right canon and the Jewish text is the right text. And then many of the Eastern Orthodox want to say, no, the Septuagint preserves an older tradition than the rabbis. And then they have this whole thing where, like, the Eastern Orthodox are trying to make the rabbis look as these evil conniving, you know what I mean? And I feel like that kind of, that fight is not, it's wholly independent from us, but I feel it sometimes seeps through the academic text. Now, I don't know if I'm reading books from the 70s or from 2020, right? So, like I don't know if that gets straightened out. But do you think, like, these kind of, like, non-Jewish debates that Christians have, like, gets projected onto your discipline?
I absolutely do. And I think that in the late 19th century, when Bible studies, like, sort of takes off among Protestant scholars in Germany, you know, there's an incredible disadvantage to understanding the Jewish perspective, simply because Jews are not in the room. They're not in the discipline yet. And there really is significant antagonism towards Judaism as it was practiced in the first century in these scholarly works. So some of the best, or, you know, best in quotation marks, some of the most well-regarded scholars of the New Testament from the 1880s, 1890s, all the way until, like you said, the 1970s or 1980s, are really sometimes overtly antagonistic. In fact, there's a very, very famous German scholar, Kittel. I don't remember his
name. Heinrich Kittel. I was just
thinking,
like a Nazi. New Testament guy. We're not going to get with the other one, the Old Testament guy, yeah.
Right, but unfortunately there are many. Joachim Jeremias. Have you read Jeremias's scholarship?
No, I don't know who that is.
Very antagonistic, and just portraying Jesus as working against the rabbis who are so ritualistic and particularistic and legalistic, and then Jesus liberates them and liberates the women from them. And, you know, it just becomes really sort of almost ahistorical. But there has been a turn in the past generation or two to really try to correct these issues. So I'm optimistic that we're moving in the right direction.
Yeah. Do you think that just being Jewish is a benefit to the academia, or does you say, or would you say, like, you know, it's nice to be Jewish, be raised Jewish, but, like, it doesn't really, like, I could be, it doesn't affect my scholarship one. Do you think your Jewish culture, like, I know that Schiffman started emphasizing the halacha in the Dead Sea Scrolls, but the Christian historians were emphasizing the messianic. So clearly his Jewish identity plays a major role in bringing out these other ideas. Do you feel that your Jewish identity is enriching to your work as a scholar?
I mean, I think anybody, any scholar who says, I do my work outside of my own personal faith, faith and practice, is just a complete liar. I don't think it's possible to really engage in scholarship outside of who you are as a person. You're asking questions. What kind of questions are you looking for? What kind of answers do you find? Of course, I'm just one person. I'm not two separate people. And so I think it would be quite arrogant to say that I do my scholarship completely objectively and outside of my own faith. That just couldn't possibly. That's
true. But does your background, you think, make you focus on things that other scholars maybe miss? Do you notice that by yourself?
I mean, probably. You know, I am also teaching Catholics at a Catholic theological school. So I'm called upon very often to sort of look for the Jewish narrative in these conversations. Sometimes, however, I will specifically ask a Catholic colleague to tell a group of Catholics what I could say, but they'll hear it differently from a Catholic. So in other words, like, for example, I try not to talk about anti-Semitism to my students, but I do get my Catholic, or I try to talk about the church's oppression of the Jews. Right. But I will ask my colleagues to own it, right? To talk about the church's oppression of the Jews, because if I talk about it, they'll be like, well, you're just a Jew.
Right, like you're just bitter.
You're just bitter. Right, so there are certain things, they definitely hear me as a Jew, just like they hear their Catholic professors as Catholics.
Right.
So some, you know, sometimes it's actually more useful to me to not say something that I would say and to ask a Catholic colleague to say the very same thing.
Right, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, because you're also an educator. It's not just like, you're not trolling online.
Right.
That makes sense, wow.
Right, but no, it definitely does inform what my interests are. It informs what my goals are, because this is not like an objective scholarly pursuit for me. It is very personal. And I feel like there's something really important that I feel, you know, needs to be done in this field. And we, you know, it intersects with so many other issues.
Right. I was studying I'm a medievalist a little bit more than Second Temple. I like the Middle Ages. That's my thing. And I noticed that, like, because I converted to Judaism, I was extremely biased against the Catholic when I studied the Crusades. And I noticed I'm reading everything. They're making an economic decision to take this route and that route, which is like a normal political move. But I'm like, oh no, it's not economic. It's like because they're evil. And then I realized, oh, I'm just like, I have like a bigotry coming from my new religion, not from the Jews, but from within. I'm like, oh, so I started reading more objectively, try to read more objectively these things. I want to thank you. It was wonderful. Maybe we should do this again on like some other topics.
It was really fun.
I really enjoyed this. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. It was really nice to get to know you finally, because I feel like we sort of did know each other, but we've never spoken. So thank you.
Right. It was like on online, you know, like Facebook friends.
Right.
Do you want to put a shout out where people can find your things, maybe which mention your books that we want to market to them? So all 8 of my listeners will buy them.
Well, I appreciate that. You can find my books, The Making of Jewish Universalism, From Exile to Alexandria, and Discovering Second Temple Literature, The Scriptures and Stories that Shaped Early Judaism, on Amazon.com and on my website, malkasimkovich.com.
Thank you so much, and have a good Hanukkah.
Thank you. Thank you. Hanukkah Sameach.